Welcome back to the Spartan History Podcast. This is episode 35, A Tale of Two Tyrants. It's been too long, dear listeners. I could regale you with stories of my offline dramas, of which there have been a few in the past couple of months, but in honesty, the delay was due mostly to anxiety on my behalf. Having spent the better part of 3 years trying to get to the Greco-Persian Wars, upon arriving at them, I had no idea on how to proceed. How could I tell the story from a Spartan perspective, when for the first pitched engagement between Greek and Persian, the Lacedaemonians were absent entirely? Moreover, the Ionian Revolt, the pretext for the whole conflict, had almost no Laconian involvement to speak of. So I vacillated between running through the standard approach to the wars, or trying to focus only on Spartan involvement. The former concept would be laborious, somewhat irrelevant to the show, and entirely overdone by others more qualified than me. The latter idea would see us jumping around chronologically, leaving gaping holes in the narrative. We've known each other for a while now, so you'd understand how I despise leaving stones unturned. I've settled on an approach that can satisfy both sides of the aisle. It just took me a long time to pull it all together, but the time is now nigh. First up, as the title suggests, we are going to be focusing on A Tale of Two Tyrants. You've got to love some alliteration. They are Aristagoras of Miletus, a figure we've come across before, but also his father-in-law, Histiaeus of Miletus. The popular narrative has Aristagoras crafting a general uprising of the various Persian-controlled Ionian Greek cities in the pursuit of democracy and freedom from the god-king's rule. We all know how that story ends. The Persians ultimately win out, resubjugate the truculent Greeks, and then launch an invasion of mainland Greece itself to punish those there that spurned Darius's favour, namely the citizens of Athens and Eretria. That invasion culminates in the Battle of Marathon in 490 BCE. Rather than just rehash that well-established narrative, I want to tell you a more in-depth story for how the Ionian Revolt kicked off. As Herodotus suggests, Aristagoras was instrumental in its genesis, but hidden in plain sight of the historian's writings is another story, one that intertwines with that of Aristagoras's. It's the story of the aforementioned Histiaeus. Often left out of retellings of the Ionian Revolt, if it wasn't for Histiaeus's enabling or even encouragement of Aristagoras's designs, the wars themselves may never have come about. We'll have to delve deeply into Book 5 of the Histories, placing the works against modern historical thought, to arrive at what I feel is a more clear understanding of the casus belli at the heart of the Greco-Persian Wars. Next, I've invited Dr. Owen Rees to come on the show. He's agreed to sit down and discuss the Battle of Marathon in detail. Owen is a renowned author who has published a number of works focusing on the classical Greek world. Most salient to our topic is his Great Battles of the Classical Greek World, in which the Battle of Marathon takes up the penultimate chapter. We'll use his expertise to deftly walk us through the engagement, but also, I want to explore the infamous Spartan tardiness that in this instance saw them miss the clash entirely. It's widely understood that Spartan adherence to religious practices, the Carneia at the time, caused the delay of their forces to Marathon. That's what Herodotus thought, but there are other, less pious theories for their absence that are worthy of exploration with Dr. Rees. After Marathon, there will be a short monologic episode where I'll cover the years between Marathon and Thermopylae. Giving a brief rundown on the formation of the Hellenic League and the Greek preparations for the assured Persian re-invasion, we'll also turn our gaze to the east to unpick the machinations of the Persian Empire as they deal with the succession crisis, consolidation of power, and finally, a mustering of a force sufficient to punish the insolent Hellenes. The next major event on the calendar is, of course, the Battle of Thermopylae. Perhaps our subject's finest and most noteworthy 3 days, bar none. There could only ever really be one person that could properly take us through those 3 days. Fortunately, he agreed to do so. Otherwise, I'd be a little riven with anxiety once again. I am talking about the one and the only, Professor Paul Cartledge. Yes, that's right, ladies and gentlemen. My historical hero is coming back to eloquently take us on the final journey of Leonidas and his 300. At the same time, we'll get to write one of the greatest travesties of modern history. In 2004, BBC In Our Time aired an episode on Thermopylae, and Professor Cartledge wasn't featured as one of the experts on the panel. Well, here at Spartan History Podcast, we won't be making that mistake. To say I'm looking particularly forward to our discussion would be a gross understatement. I'm popping mad with excitement. To round off the battle and ultimate defeat of the Spartans and their allies, I'll be doing another interview with Professor Stephen Hodkinson. He's good friends with Professor Cartledge and moreover is extremely eminent in the field of Spartan research. His particular line of expertise revolves around the real Spartan story, one stripped back of any influence by the Spartan mirage. We'll look at Spartan society prior to the war, how the nature of that society didn't necessarily provide the perfect soldier for it, but how the circumstances of Thermopylae were, for lack of a better word, exceptional. We'll also discuss the myth-making that began the moment the last Persian arrow felled the final defiant Spartan upon that small knoll in the pass. It'll be a great way to ground ourselves after the dizzying and spectacular retelling of the battle we are sure to get from Professor Cartledge. Lastly, for interviews, we're going to have back on an old friend of the show, Professor Paul Barthunius, to recount the Battle of Plataea. Paul has actually just returned home after visiting the fields of Plataea. There, along with a number of other hoplite enthusiasts, Paul belatedly, due to COVID, celebrated the 2,500-year anniversary of the battle. They camped on the field, donned their amazing panoplies of authentic arms and armour, and reenacted the epochal clash. I can't wait to hear Paul's stories of his trip and his retelling of the battle itself. It will surely be a thrilling and very distinct perspective of Plataea. I'm really looking forward to hearing Paul's and the rest of my guests' thoughts on their various subjects. To wrap up my Greco-Persian War series, I'll do a conglomerate episode, squeezing together the other conflicts and events of the period. The Battle of Salamis and of Mycale will be covered, along with the dissolution of the Hellenic League. From there, the narrative will shift into the somewhat dark period between the ending of the Persian Wars to the beginning of the Peloponnesian War. Let's talk about that later. Much later. For now, that is the plan. No more equivocating. Time to dive in. I give you all the Greco-Persian War series, Steve Whitehead style. A Tale of Two Tyrants. I really love that title. Drums. In Book 1 of his histories, Herodotus lays out for his readers what he sees as the genesis of the great conflicts we today call the Greco-Persian Wars. Ever grandiose in his narrative, he cites Bronze Age or heroic mythology as the place where the Persians first developed serious and protracted grievances against their western neighbours. The Persians, absolving themselves of guilt, say it was the Phoenicians and not they who first transgressed against the Greeks. A people well known for their naval expertise, the story goes that on one of their many voyages across the Mediterranean, they made birth at the city of Argos. Like Thebes, Argos was in the Bronze Age an extremely important place in the stuff of legend. Having spent some 5 or 6 days in port and beginning to run out of wares for sale, the Phoenicians were preparing to weigh anchor when a group of women came down to peruse the last of the foreign wares. One of them just so happened to be the daughter of the Argive king. She was called Io, or Io in English. This is the same princess who Zeus fell in love with and was subsequently turned into a white heifer by the thunder god to prevent his wife from discovering another of his many trysts. I can't work out how to reconcile the two narratives for Io, but it didn't seem to bother Herodotus too much, and nor should it give us cause for concern. Anyways, the Phoenicians struck upon a plan to capture some of these unsuspecting women and carry them off. Deeply engrossed in shiny Phoenician baubles, many of them were caught unaware and bundled up into the cargo hold of the now departing vessel. Io was amongst them. This, according to Herodotus, was the first unjust act between East and West. Later on, and apparently in an ambiguous act of retaliation, some Greeks, Herodotus believes them to be from Crete, sailed to the Phoenician port of Tyre on the Levantine coast. It's a beautiful place with a very rich history. In historic times, it was situated on an island some half a mile from the mainland and very defensible. That was, of course, until Alexander the Great came along and, in besieging and encircling the island, built a long causeway to attach it to the mainland, enabling the conqueror to attack with both his land and sea forces simultaneously. This man-made isthmus has accumulated so much silt over the centuries since that the once separate island is now joined permanently to the coast and is entirely indistinguishable from the surrounding land. In Tyre, the Cretan sailors carried off, in turn, the Tyrian king's daughter. Her name was Europa. She also had a counter-narrative involving, you guessed it, an affair with Zeus, but once again, we won't let that bother us. Herodotus simply puts the event down to a good old case of tit for tat, so to speak. If only they let sleeping dogs lie. But Jason and his merry band of Argonauts had to sail into the Colchis and not only take the pretty golden fleece of nasty King Aetes, they also appropriated his daughter, Medea. Aetes demanded redress. Not only that, he chased the Argonauts across the known and unknown world with his entire fleet, but the Greeks would not hand the princess back. According to the historian, they received no such satisfaction when Io was abducted, so felt it their right to reciprocate. I guess they forgot about the Europa affair, or more likely they were simply unaware of the Byzantine nature of Greek mythology. As always, one turn deserved another, and a generation after the Argo's disorderly return, a Trojan ship pulled into a Spartan-controlled harbour. The ship had in its complement two Trojan princes, Hector and Paris. We're fairly well acquainted with that particular narrative, so no need to go into it here. Like Aetes and Medea, the Greeks demanded Helen's return, but, citing the former event, the Trojans saw no need to hand back their prize. What had up until now been just a simple matter of stealing princesses became a truly serious issue when the Greeks assembled the mightiest army their world had yet seen and set off to Troy to bring back the Spartan beauty. Herodotus says that while the unsanctioned procurement of a foreign princess was, in and of itself, an unlawful act, it was hardly worthwhile enough to get worked up into a serious state of conflict over. Agamemnon and the assembled Greek kings begged to differ, and the 10-year-long Trojan War and destruction of Priam's empire was to become the spark that lit permanent antagonism between the Persian and Greek peoples. Even though Persia wasn't precisely around during the Bronze Age, as they were the inheritors of the land in question, Phoenicia and Colchis, they too inherited the anger and desire for revenge. The Greeks placed the start of the Greco-Persian aggressions at a slightly more contemporary time. They lay the blame squarely at the feet of King Croesus. We're told that whilst his ancestors had warred for generations against the Ionian and Aeolian Greeks, they never did more than a little harmless pillage. You know, a few burnt fields here, a couple of flaming thatched roofs there, and maybe even the odd unsuspecting villager carried off into servitude, but nothing too serious. It was Croesus who first began, and then concluded successfully, wars of conquest against the Greek peoples of Asia Minor. Not content with merely plunder, he extended his Lydian empire to an extent his forebears could have only dreamed. This, according to Uncle H at least, brought the Hellenic and Persian destinies into inextricable entanglement. The historian, as in so many other instances, leaves these two differing narratives up in the air to percolate in the reader's mind. He is explicit in saying that he vouches for neither, and is merely repeating the history as it was told to him. Of course, these views are biased by the sources he had at his disposal, both literary and verbal. The Persian tale is one common amongst any two peoples that eventually, after long and protracted relationships, come to blows. Whether Roman versus Etruscan, Mongol versus Jin, or a great many other such conflicts. The Greek version perhaps lays a good framework, but it isn't the full nor entirely correct story. The Ionian Revolt is often cited as the ignition point for the Greco-Persian Wars. However, the flame was already lying dormant by 499 and the acts of Aristagoras of Miletus. The spark for that flame occurred in 507, when the Athenians, fearing the return of the thoroughly anti-democratic Cleomenes I, appealed for succour from none other than the Achaemenid Empire to the east. We went through the context of that event in detail in our episode on the Spartan King, and in the previous one, Trevor Cully cited the act as the Grand Conflict's origin, but in brief, let's set it up to make it fresh in the mind. By this time, late 6th century BCE, Cleomenes had all but given up the hope of reinstating Isagoras as ruler in Athens, and had, funnily enough, decided that Hippias was his man. Funny, because it was Cleomenes himself who deposed Hippias in 510, thus ending the rule of the Pisistrate in Athens. That being said, Cleomenes, and Sparta itself, had been tricked into removing Hippias due to a false Delphic oracle which was induced by Athenian silver. Despite being renowned as a tyrant, Toplitus, the Lacedaemonians had long-standing and good relationships with Hippias and his family. And besides, from their point of view, any form of government was preferable to a burgeoning democracy in Athens. Therefore, the Spartan king's change of heart is somewhat understandable when considered in this light. Post his ousting, Hippias took up residence in Sardis and swore allegiance to Darius. It was due to the intent of Cleomenes that the embryonic Athenian democracy turned to Persia for help. What they believed the might of Persia could do from the other side of the Aegean Sea against the proximal threat of Sparta was anyone's guess. The Spartans certainly didn't fear Persia. Remember the nasty letter they sent to Cyrus in support of King Croesus some half a century earlier? It's likely the Athenians were desperate and wished to cow the Lacedaemonians into cancelling their plans of invasion by any means necessary. That, and as we'll see, Athenian democracy wasn't really equipped to deal with long-term plans for foreign, or for that matter domestic policy. So it came to pass that Athens sent envoys to Sardis to plead their case. There, the ambassadors met the satrap, Artaphernes, who was brother to the great king. Herodotus tells us the following in regards to the encounter in Book 5 of his work. The Athenians dispatched envoys to Sardis, desiring to make an alliance with the Persians, for they knew that they had provoked the Lacedaemonians and Cleomenes to war. When the envoys came to Sardis and spoke as they had been bidden, Artaphernes, son of Hystaspes, viceroy of Sardis, asked them, "What men are you, and where do you dwell who desire an alliance with the Persians?" Being informed by the envoys, he gave them an answer to the effect of, "If the Athenians gave King Darius earth and water, then he would make alliance with them, but if not, his command was that they should be gone." The envoys consulted together and consented to give what was asked in their desire to make alliance. In short, given the option of returning to Athens with nothing to show for their troubles, the envoys agreed to Artaphernes' demands and provided the required earth and water. It's telling that the viceroy of Sardis had no idea who the Athenians were at this point, or from where they hailed. The words of Artaphernes echoed those attributed to Cyrus back in the 540s, when Sparta sent an embassy to the great king in defense of the Ionian Greeks now under Persian dominion. In that instance, the great king mockingly said, "Tell me, who are the Spartans?" His successors would in time have good cause to know the men from both cities. In the meantime, Hippias returned to Attica as the feared invasion of Cleomenes came to fruition. As we've seen, that invasion turned into a debacle as the Archaid king's authority was undermined by his Europontid co-king's meddling ways. Hippias had to grab the return ferry back to Asia Minor and wound up at Sardis once more. There, he pled his case to the viceroy, who sent instructions to Athens that they should allow the former tyrant's return and place themselves under his command once more. Naturally, these orders were disobeyed as the Athenian democracy never ratified the treaty offered up the previous year. Moreover, the two diplomats who provided the earth and water were severely reprimanded. Regardless, to the Persian mindset at least, after offering the tokens of submission, Athens became de facto part of the Persian Empire and were considered by the great king as a distant vassal. This, and not the Ionian Revolt, is the real pretext at the heart of the Greco-Persian Wars. Now, as we'll see, the revolt certainly put the Persians in a position to punish their wayward subjects. Also during this time period, tyrannies as a style of government had begun to slowly go out of favour with the local populaces. The reasons for this vary. For example, in the Peloponnese, the Spartans toppled quite a few dictators and installed or promoted oligarchies in their stead. Elsewhere, it was due to increasing wealth of the noble and citizen classes who chomped at the bit of authoritarianism and demanded greater and greater levels of enfranchisement. There were exceptions, of course, Syracuse being the most prominent. But by and large, by about 500 BCE, most tyrannies were gone for one reason or another in the Greek world. If you looked at the rulers of the Ionian cities of Asia Minor at this time, the situation was the complete opposite. It wasn't because the Greeks here still preferred autocracy. They most certainly didn't. The Persians, now in control of these cities having deposed Croesus and annihilated the Lydian Empire, found that tyrannies were the best way to control the unruly Greeks. Independence seemed to be an intrinsic facet of the Greek psyche, and rather than absolutism of rule, the Achaemenid kings allowed appointed proxies to rule in their stead, though assuredly at their bequest. This was the situation in 499. There were 12 cities in the Persian-controlled Ionian League, and each had their own tyrant, and each citizen body chafed under the despotism of their unconstitutionally appointed ruler. Many of their names are lost to the sands of time, but one, Aristagoras of Miletus, has had his name etched through infamy into the story of the upcoming tectonic struggle. There are two popular versions of the tale. The first is obviously Herodotus' own narrative, in which Aristagoras is a silver-tongued, self-aggrandizing coward. Or the one of modern historical thought, which on occasion meddles slightly with the story to make the man appear to be a national hero, an advocate for freedom, justice, and the pan-Hellenic way, if you will. The truth is likely, and as is so often the case, somewhere in between the two. It's never really focused on, but a decent share of the story belongs to Aristagoras' father-in-law, Histiaeus, the real tyrant of Miletus. A somewhat inexplicable and perturbing figure in the histories, a man of mystery, if you will. It all starts in around the year 513, when Darius, who had already brought much of Thrace under Persian control, marched north along the western shores of the Black Sea with his army. His force was made up largely of Ionian, Aeolic, and Hellespontine contingents. At the Danube, they were met by the Ionian fleet, and there, a bridge was constructed that allowed the great king's forces to penetrate north into Scythia, the expedition's express goal. The Scythians had been, and would continue to be, a thorn in the side of any peoples that neighboured them. Herodotus tells us that the king intended to pull down the bridge after his crossing, but was convinced by the Greek strategos to leave it up just in case. We are led to believe that many of the Persian-appointed tyrants of the once-free Greek cities stayed behind with the fleet to defend the crossing, while Darius marched north at the head of his forces. Notable amongst the leaders left behind was one Miltiades, who at that early period was tyrant of a colony in what is today the modern Gallipoli Peninsula, southwest of Istanbul. Another was Histiaeus, tyrant of Miletus. The expedition, like so many others into Scythia, was a disaster, and having been drawn into the region of modern Crimea, Darius and his beleaguered forces were confronted by a scorched earth policy enacted by the roving Scythians. Starved, wounded and demoralized, they beat a hasty retreat back to the Danube. In the meantime, back at the bridge, dissent was sowing itself amongst the assembled Greek tyrants, and they'd effectively split into two camps. One was for burning the bridge and leaving the Persian ruler stranded in no man's land. This faction was egged on by none other than Miltiades, the general, who would later lead the Athenians at Marathon. It is perhaps Herodotus's way of displaying this general's anti-Persian vein at even this early date, but we'll have to take his word for it. The other faction, led by Histiaeus, was for acknowledging that without the backing of Darius, their own tyrannies would soon crumble with them being left at the mercy of their former subjects. The Scythians sent scouts ahead of the Persian force who, arriving at the bridge, threw their weight on the side of Miltiades. "The god king is naught but dust without this bridge," they said. "Burn it to the waterline and liberate yourselves and your people." Fortunately for Darius, the reason of Histiaeus won out eventually. But to allay the ferocious Scythians, the Greeks broke down a section of the bridge, the northern one, and closest to the fleeing Persian force. When the retreating force arrived at the crossing, they were initially alarmed to see that it was in part broken down. Darius, however, ordered an Egyptian, with a very loud voice, you gotta love his little details, to call out by name to Histiaeus, who answered immediately. Thereafter, effecting a successful retreat, the king and his entourage convalesced at Sardis, where he summoned Histiaeus to his presence. Asking what reward he would like for his service, the tyrant of Miletus decided on the region of Myrcinus as his prize, which was located within Macedonian Thrace. It was an area abundantly supplied with timber for shipbuilding and a few decent silver mines to boot. If not for this bequest, the story of Histiaeus, Miltiades, and the bridge could be written off as sheer fallacy, but to be gifted such a prize, Histiaeus must have performed a great service indeed. This lends an extreme amount of credibility to the tale. Moreover, in 511 or 510, Miltiades, having resumed his tyranny in the Chersonese, was attacked by local tribes of Scythians. There was at this time a Persian army still stationed in Thrace, which could have, but didn't, assist the tyrant. Miltiades was forced to flee and ended up returning to Athens where, if he wasn't anti-Persian by persuasion before, he most certainly was now. The key takeaways from this little episode are two. First, the fact that Darius summoned Histiaeus by name showed that he already trusted the tyrant of Miletus, a trust further bolstered by faithful service and further rewarded with Myrcinus. And second, that word of Miltiades' attempted perfidy at the Danubian bridge clearly reached Darius's ear, and rather than support his tyranny, the king left his wayward subject to the mercies of the Scythians. Mercies the god king was well familiar with. In the next episode, Darius takes Histiaeus back to the Persian capital, Susa, as his trusted advisor. It has been suggested by modern historians that this was to keep an eye on the Milesian tyrant, but as we've seen already, Histiaeus was well aware that his power rested on the good graces of the god king. And, having been rewarded with extra territory for good service, it simply doesn't stand to reason that Histiaeus now would decide to turn coat. No, it was as a confidant and an ally that Histiaeus spent his time in Susa, rather than a political prisoner. Nevertheless, the event left the door wide open for the Ionian revolt due to the person left in charge of Histiaeus' holdings in Miletus and Mercenas, his son-in-law and cousin, one Aristagoras. It is conjectured, and I tend to agree, that tendencies of confederacy had been brewing for some time within the Persian-controlled region of Greek Ionia. Tendencies perhaps stoked by the Persians themselves. By bringing a collective force together for the Scythian expedition, Darius showed the Greeks how similar they were in comparison to the Eastern barbarians. These feelings were only amplified by what occurred next. Aristagoras, now in control of Miletus and Mercenas, at least nominally, decided it was high time he struck out on his own and forge a little destiny for himself. But how to build a name when his father-in-law was in control, de jure, of Aristagoras's two de facto holdings? He needed to go big, and some Naxian exiles who arrived at Miletus provided him with exactly the kind of pretext he required. The exiles were the families of the aristocrats and Persian puppet rulers who had been ousted by a popular uprising on the island, a foreshadow to the greater Ionian revolt on the horizon. They had some long-standing xenia, or guest friendship, with the absent Histiaeus, and sought his help to return home. I can appreciate their sentiments, having personally spent a considerable amount of time on Naxos over the years. It's a lovely place, and I'd want to return too. This was of no consequence to Aristagoras, however, but he was as agreeable as possible with the exiles, seeing via their cause a means to his own ends. The exiles' plight was precisely the thing he was looking for. As a mere tyrant, Aristagoras could do little by himself. He needed some substantial backing, the royal stamp of authority, so to speak. The resident satrap, Artaphernes of Sardis, was the man to provide such. As mentioned, this satrap was brother to Darius, and his precarious position rested on his ability to provide good service to the king by maintaining stability in the western holdings of the empire. Should he be able to enlarge them, more the better. Artaphernes was also jealous of Histiaeus, who was now residing in the luxurious apartments of Susa, close to the god king, a position the satrap thought the foreigner unworthy of. Therefore, he was more than happy to further the cause of Aristagoras to the detriment of Histiaeus. After consulting with Darius, Artaphernes fronted up some Persian gold to raise an army and equip a fleet of 200 triremes for the planned invasion of Naxos, the largest island in the Cycladic grouping. It was extremely likely, if not certain, that this fleet was comprised by many of the same naval commanders and oarsmen that were earlier at the Danube River during Darius's failed Scythian invasion. Feelings of nationalism were sure to increase, as this time they weren't against some mysterious northern peoples, but instead Greeks, just like themselves. Aristagoras was elected strategos of the collective Ionian forces underneath the overall command of Megabates, cousin to both Artaphernes and Darius. The fleet initially set sail north to the island of Chios in an apparent feint designed to obfuscate their intended target. Once there, they doubled back and set course for Naxos. On the way, issues between Greek and Persian flared up when Megabates, a strict disciplinarian, personally inspected the assembled fleet when it was at mooring one night. During his rounds, the Persian commander found a ship from the Greek city of Mindus without a watch posted. He had his guard drag the ship's captain, one Skylax of Mindus, before him. Megabates meted out a severe and humiliating punishment, having Skylax shoved through an oar hole and left tied half in and half out of the ship. As the notional commander of the Greeks, an appeal reached the ear of Aristagoras to deliver poor Skylax from his fate as a human oar. The tyrant of Miletus met with Megabates and implored the Persian to release the Greek captain at once, but was rebuffed. Taking matters into his own hands, Aristagoras personally cut away Skylax's bonds and in the process raised his profile amongst the assembled Greeks inestimably. It's almost universally agreed upon by modern historians that what happened next was either a story concocted by Herodotus, or simply a popular tale of the time inserted in the histories to explain what occurred. The historian tells us that Megabates' rage at being disobeyed was so great, his ire so piqued, that he sabotaged the entire expedition by sending word to the Naxians of the fleet's imminent arrival. Even the story of Scylax can be reasonably doubted. What is clear, however, that regardless of pretext, antagonism between Greek and Persian was reaching an all-time high during the expedition. Like elsewhere, in the Greek world, the time of willing submission to kings and tyrants by the Hellenes was fast coming to a close. Either way, by the time the invasion fleet arrived at the eponymously named capital of Naxos, they found a city brimming with defenders and supplies. There is no need to assume that it was an annoyed Megabates who warned them. It had been over a year since the popular uprising on the island had banished the puppet aristocrats. Aristagoras and Artaphernes had taken their time in assembling an invasion force. More than enough time for word to have reached the island of the future in store for them. It just doesn't stand to reason that Megabates would besmirch both of his cousins' honour by contriving at a failed invasion. In Persia, prestige and position was everything. Had word reached Darius of Megabates' duplicity, as it seems to have reached Herodotus's, the Persian commander would have not long after found his head separated from his shoulders. When instead, he is later given his own satrapy, hardly the reward of a traitor. The historian's narrative of the siege is unclear. It seems at first the invaders made an all-out assault on the Naxian Acropolis. This was repelled, with heavy losses on the attacking side. Megabates and his forces then settled into a general encirclement to attempt to starve the defenders into submission. After 4 months of little to no success, the expedition, already frayed at the command level, ran out of money, and the decision was made to depart back to Asia Minor, tail tucked firmly between their legs. It was now that the real trouble began for Aristagoras. The failure of the mission was immensely humiliating for Megabates, doubly so for Artaphernes, who had pitched it to his brother, the great king, and ponied up the gold to fund the whole undertaking. The Greek tyrants were nothing but a necessary evil for the Persians. The decision to scapegoat Aristagoras would have appeared as obvious to the Persian high command as it seems to us in the present. You can almost see Artaphernes dictating the very letter to Susa to explain away the defeat at Naxos. Sire, if it wasn't for that meddlesome Aristagoras, all would have been well, but he and his capricious Greeks were naught but trouble and caused our collective enterprise to be undone. Or words to that effect, at least. Even Histiaeus was sure to be extremely displeased with his son-in-law. Not only had Aristagoras offered Histiaeus' Naxian friends no help in achieving their wishes, that is, restoration to primacy on Naxos, but the holdings that were rightfully his, Miletus and Myrkinos, were placed in serious jeopardy due to the failure. The rightful tyrant, excuse the oxymoron, of Miletus was assuredly aware of the machinations of his son-in-law in combination with Artaphernes. The Persian satrap floated the idea of the expedition with Darius initially, and ensconced within the Susan court, and no doubt eager for news from the west, was Histiaeus himself. Did he have an opportunity to counsel Darius against sanctioning the expedition? He was in an extremely difficult position. On one hand, he surely wanted his Naxian friends to receive help, but on the other, would have feared the prestige Aristagoras was to gain by successfully completing his objective of restoring said Naxians to power. Moreover, Histiaeus was certainly aware of Artaphernes' disdain, and quite likely feared the ulterior motives held by the satrap with his assistance of Aristagoras. For Artaphernes, it was a win-win situation. If Aristagoras was successful, the satrap could claim responsibility for adding to Darius's domains. Was he unsuccessful, then Artaphernes could parlay that failure to discredit not only Aristagoras, but by extension his father-in-law. Aristagoras was many things. Stupid does not seem to be one of them, though. On returning to Miletus, he was aware of how precarious his position was. It was only a matter of time before Artaphernes became knocking in demand of restitution for the costs of war. He jumped onto the feelings of patriotism that had been brewing amongst the Ionian Greeks by renouncing his tyranny of Miletus in favour of what can only be described as a form of democracy. By hook or by crook, he rounded up his fellow Ionian tyrants, who for better or for worse, could not be persuaded to his cause. And in all honesty, why would they? It was Aristagoras, and not they, who was the focus of Persian ire. After all, they had their own tyrannies to worry about. With Miletus now in open revolt from Persia, proud of its new government, Aristagoras handed over the tyrants to their various cities, who, following Milesian fashion, preferred democracy over tyranny and banished their former overlords. Save in one case, that of Mytilene on Lesbos, which decided to stone their ex-tyrant to death rather than just banish him. There it was in a nutshell. With the installation of democratic function in the Ionian cities, they rose up together and threw off the Persian yoke. The forces from the failed Naxian expedition were still largely together, located at Myos, a city barely 20 kilometres east of Miletus. This gave the rebels a ready-made naval and military force with which to actively promote their insurrection. Herodotus tells an extremely romantic tale about Histiaeus' part in the rebellion. He relates that when he received word of Aristagoras' failure, he shaved the head of a loyal servant and tattooed a message on his scalp. Allowing enough time for the servant's hair to grow and cover the communique, he was sent directly to the presence of Aristagoras in Miletus. Apparently, the message was Histiaeus telling his son-in-law that revolt was his only option, and he had his father-in-law's support. This apparent invention by Herodotus is possibly to support something Aristagoras told the Milesians when he called them all into a council on the eve of the revolt. The collective representatives of the cities, new democratic governments, were there, and they were told that Histiaeus himself strongly endorses their autonomy, and that Aristagoras was merely acting as his proxy with full support. There are many reasons to doubt this story and its tattooed scalped plot device. Firstly, unlike the story of the Danube River, there is nothing ancillary to the event that supports Histiaeus now deciding to turn traitor. He had everything to lose by democratic rule in Miletus, foremost his own tyranny. Second, Herodotus could never have been able to verify such a story. It seems purely fiction in its placement of his narrative, designed to explain the inexplicable. Histiaeus was well aware of what had happened to his fellow tyrants. There was nothing to assure him that he would not share the same fate should he ever return to Miletus. Lastly, the only feelings Histiaeus felt towards his son-in-law were ones of anger and contempt. Aristagoras had, after all, let down his Naxian friends, threatened his claim on Miletus and Myrcinus, and put him in an extremely difficult position at the court of Darius. It's been proposed, and I wholeheartedly agree, there were only messages sent by Histiaeus to Aristagoras regarding revolt, tattooed scalps notwithstanding, then it would have been a message of challenge, not one of support. By stepping down from tyranny in Miletus and installing democracy, Aristagoras robbed his father-in-law of his rightful fiefdom. What better way for Histiaeus to regain it than to have Aristagoras attempt the impossible, permanent freedom from Persian rule? Once the inevitable came to pass and the revolt was squashed, who better to rule in Miletus, or for that matter Ionia, than the ever-loyal Histiaeus? His only crime was trusting too much in a family member, something Darius, from experience, could sympathise with. To understand the depths of feeling the great king held for Histiaeus, I'll quote you a passage from Book 5 of the Histories. It is the apparent reasoning for wanting the Greek to accompany Darius to Susa as a trusted advisor. In the words Herodotus places coming straight from the tongue of Darius, "I will tell you, Histiaeus, why I sent for you. Ever since I lost sight of you after my return from Scythia, I have never desired anything so much as to see and to talk to you again, for I am convinced that a man's most precious possession is a wise and loyal friend, and that you are both of these things, my own experience has shown." Histiaeus had everything to lose and nothing to gain by assisting Aristagoras. I completely discount that the two were working together to bring about an independent Ionia. Aristagoras was simply interested in saving his own skin by any means necessary, and Histiaeus wanted what was rightfully his. After the Danubian event, the god-king offered him whatever his heart desired, and he was in turn granted Myrcinus. I posit that Histiaeus was loyal to his own ends, until the very end, but those ends aligned with Darius's, and that was extremely convenient for both of them. Back in Ionia, Aristagoras wastes no time in building upon his burgeoning power base. He went personally to the mainland, where he first tried to gain Spartan support, which we covered in our episode on Cleomenes, after which he managed to convince the Athenians of the justice of his cause. The triremes from Athens, 20 in total, were joined by some men from the Euboean city of Eretria, with another 5 triremes fitted for war. A paltry force compared to the mainland's entire manpower, but it was enough to galvanise the brewing resistance in Ionia. In 498, the forces assembled at Ephesus and began to march on the regional capital and home of Artaphernes, Sardis. Aristagoras didn't lead the attack. The honour was instead bestowed on his brother, Charapanus. This suggests to me that Aristagoras wasn't secure in his home base of Miletus. Whether he feared a local revolt or the return of his father-in-law, it isn't clear. Either way, rather than leading the force as would have been expected, he waited. At Sardis, the rebels were initially successful, having caught the Persians relatively unawares. They captured the town below the Acropolis and burnt it to the ground. The fire and smoke eventually brought out the Persian garrison who fought the Greeks amongst the smouldering ruins of the town. Having apparently bitten off more than they could chew, the rebel force quickly lost heart and began an organized retreat back to Ephesus. They were caught up with outside the city by a pursuing force of mainly Persian cavalry and utterly routed. The Eretrian commander, Ulcides, was amongst the many Greek dead. No further offensive was attempted by the Hellenes. The Ionian survivors retreated to their respective cities, and the Athenian and Eretrians boarded their triremes and sailed back to the mainland. We all know how this story of revolt ends, so I won't bore you with the slow attrition that saw the Ionian cities one by one fall back under the sway of Persian dominion. I will finish, though, with the ends of both Aristagoras and Histiaeus, which were decidedly sticky, and in the latter's case, rather transfixing, if you will. In his narrative, Herodotus describes that after the attack on Sardis, an apoplectic Darius summons Histiaeus before him for what surely amounted to a massive, please explain. In summary, the king said the following. He is your son by marriage, Histiaeus. How could you not have known what he was plotting? And after all the trust and honour I've bestowed upon you, this is how you repay me? Assuming a pose of what was likely the most graphic depiction of abject genuflection you would ever see, Histiaeus responds accordingly. Quoting once more from Book 5. My lord, how can you say such a thing? Is it likely that I should plan to do anything which might injure you in any way whatever, small or great? I have all I want. So what motive could there be for such treachery? Is not what is yours mine? And have I not the honour of sharing all of your counsels? If my deputy at Miletus is indeed guilty of such a thing, you may be very sure that he has acted entirely on his own. Darius is placated. I'd like to quickly focus on the word Histiaeus used to describe Aristagoras. He calls him his deputy, or epitropos in Greek. It can be translated as steward, or guardian more correctly. It shows that in Histiaeus's, or Herodotus' mind at least, Miletus never belonged to Aristagoras. At any rate, Histiaeus convinces Darius to let him leave Susa and head back to Miletus to try and rein in the damage already committed by his son-in-law. Herodotus claims that this was his intention all along, fabricating a means for release from Darius's court. I hope I have provided enough evidence so far to largely discount this as a factor. I think Histiaeus genuinely intended to bring Aristagoras to justice and re-establish his power base in Miletus and Myrkinos. In the meantime, Aristagoras' popular support went up in smoke, first with the reversal at Sardis, and then the utter defeat of the Ionian forces outside of Ephesus. The Milesians could see the descent of the Persian yoke, and would be damned if they went down with Aristagoras, the architect of the entire debacle. Ever wily, the would-be hero departed for the other holdings of Histiaeus, Myrkinos. There it is supposed that he would attempt to harness the wealth of the place to bolster the flaking Ionian resistance, but it's just as likely that he was trying to carve out a secure power base for himself, as far from Persia as possible. Which in reality, is what he was trying to do originally with the Naxos affair. He knew he wasn't the real power in Miletus, or Myrkinos. That was his father-in-law's purview. Unfortunately for poor Aristagoras, with his intent firmly on his own independent domain, he attacked a nearby Thracian town, where he and all of his men were slaughtered. It's an inglorious end for the would-be tyrant, having achieved nothing but death and ruin in Ionia. I find it difficult, despite all of the best intentions being assigned to Aristagoras, to believe that he for one moment wanted a free and autonomous Ionia. As for Histiaeus, well, he arrived in Sardis shortly after Aristagoras left for Myrkinos, or quite possibly whilst his son-in-law was still in Miletus. It would at least explain why he went to Sardis first, and not to his former domain. The resident satrap of Sardis, Artaphernes, had no love for Histiaeus, and casting his gaze out across his burnt city, must have had dark thoughts on his mind. Once Aristagoras had left Ionia, however, realization dawned on both men. For Artaphernes, he knew that Histiaeus could be of absolutely no use to him, and worse, could further foment the rebellion. Histiaeus knew all of this, and realised that he had been completely undone by his deputy's flight. He would never be able to keep his word with the god-king now, in delivering up Aristagoras, and moreover, had no power base of his own. Miletus, now under revolt and democratic rule, and Mycenas, too far distant, and under the control of one not loyal to himself. Histiaeus, weighing all of this up, flees Sardis in terror. He crossed first to Chios, where he manages to convince the locals to support him in regaining control of Miletus. Unfortunately, the force he is supplied with isn't up to the task, and the Milesians rebuff him, having no taste for another tyrant, especially after ridding themselves of that pesky Aristagoras. It seems he was seeking a path to redemption. Had he gotten the reins of power in Miletus firmly under his control, he could offer it in subjugation to the great king, at least in part keeping his word. This seems highly likely. From there, he returned once more to Chios, but perhaps suspecting his personal motives, the Chians this time sent him away empty-handed. He then headed to Mytilene, where he received better treatment and was gifted 8 triremes. An insufficient force to take Miletus, but Histiaeus decided to put them to a different use. He sailed to the Bosporus and sought to capture grain ships headed for Miletus, thus forcing the city to allow him to resume control or starve. It was too late for Histiaeus. That year, 494 BCE, the Ionians were finally crushed at the naval battle of Lade, losing some 246 of their 353 assembled ships. Soon after, Miletus fell, and the Ionian part of the revolt was all but over. Running out of options, he decided to return to Chios, who had lost a great many men at Lade and were thus an easy conquest for Histiaeus and his forces. Here it seems he got greedy and had attempted to recover his former Thracian city of Mykenos. Aristagoras had really irked the local Thracians, who were in no mood for Greek tyrants, so he was once more rebuffed in his designs. On the way back to Ionia, word reached Histiaeus of the Persian fleet's journey to reconquer the islands of the Ionian coast. If he could just get back to Chios in time, he could offer up to the Persians and maybe, just maybe, resume his former position of tyrant with the support of Darius. It wasn't to be. Short on supplies, he landed with his fleet at Artanias, opposite the Isle of Lesbos, and was there captured by the Persian commander Harpagus. He promptly and personally delivered Histiaeus to Sardis and its satrap, Artaphernes. On arrival, and under orders of the satrap, Histiaeus was immediately impaled and had his head cut off, which was then sent, after being mummified, to Darius in Susa. Darius was deeply angered by the actions of Harpagus and Artaphernes. In the god-king's mind, Histiaeus was a friend, trusted advisor, and loyal subject. To my mind, Darius was likely correct on all three accounts. Aside from certain contrivances mentioned by Herodotus, there is little to suggest that Histiaeus played any role in organising or perpetuating the Ionian revolt. As we only have the historian's account to go by, it is extremely difficult to make any other assumption that's valid. That being said, Darius had the head washed and tended, then buried with all honour due a man who had done good service to Persia and the king. And in Herodotus' own words from Book 6, so ends the story of Histiaeus, and also our own tale of the two tyrants, though that wasn't in Book 6. Before we wrap up, I'd like to draw your attention to an event in Herodotus' timeline that occurred just before the great king's last meeting with Histiaeus, the alive version, that is, not the decapitated one. It foreshadows the focus of our next episode with Dr. Owen Rees, the Battle of Marathon. We're told that upon learning of the Ionians' destruction of Sardis, Darius didn't give a thought to the Ionians, as he knew they would one day be under his heel once more. Strangely, because apparently they had already provided him with earth and water, but we'll permit Herodotus some license here, he asked, who were these Athenians? On being told, he called for his bow and an arrow, and firing up into the air, the king exclaimed, "Grant, O God, that I may punish these Athenians." Then he commanded a servant to repeat to him 3 times these words whenever he sat down to dine. "Master, remember the Athenians." And next, when the Spartan History Podcast returns, we'll be remembering the Athenians too, as with Dr. Owen Rees's help, we'll dissect the Battle of Marathon. So by all means, I'm not sure when, but it will be soon, join me for episode 36, Marathon. Until then, dear listeners, take good care and speak soon. It's with some sadness that I have to announce my website will be taken down shortly. It was hacked a couple of months ago, and Wix, the provider, have been unable to resolve the issue. The website was supposed to be a resource to support the show. Now it's a place where my dear members are getting spammed by what appear to be foreign bot farms. That's not cool. Thanks to everyone that's used it for its intended purpose, and I'll still be contactable at both SpartanHistoryPodcast@hotmail.com and SpartanHistoryPodcast@gmail.com. That being said, the site is still up. If you'd like to contribute to the show, please head over to www.SpartanHistoryPodcast.com, where you'll see on the homepage buttons for Buy Me a Coffee and PayPal. Alternatively, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/Spartan History or paypal.me/Spartan History. You can find me on Twitter at Spartan History and on Facebook too at Spartan History Podcast. If you like this episode and are keen to hear more, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your pods from and leave a review. See you next time.